Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. So the Electoral College has met and elected Joe Biden president, and Mitch McConnell has finally congratulated Biden. After a close brush with the end of democracy in America, is all well now? Or does this close call actually amplify all the weaknesses and undemocratic features of what we call democracy in America? Today we talk again with Sightline Institute's Kristen Eberhard, whose new book, Becoming a Democracy, provides tools for turning a very flawed electoral system into one that embraces all the democratic ideals the current one merely gives lip service to. Kristen, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Well, the last time we talked, it was right after the election, but before we knew who was going to be the winner. Well, we sort of knew it would be Biden, but it hadn't become official yet. By the time the show aired, people had been dancing in the streets for 2 days. So I want to go back to when you were just finishing the book and projecting from that point on, what did you not imagine could have happened when you were finishing the book that did happen as a result of this election?
I did not imagine that elected Republicans would support President Trump in contesting election results that were clearly not contestable. I expected that, you know, President Trump had been very clear that he would not accept defeat, whether fair and legal or not. But I was not expecting the amount of support he got in that illegal position from other elected officials.
I'm surprised at how many Republican secretaries of state and other election officials actually stood by the count and stood up to President Trump. And I wonder if that gave you any sense of relief, considering that there were so many Republican elected officials who were supporting his bogus claims that he'd won the election.
I saw a distinction between Republican election officials like Grace Berger, and who is the Secretary of State. In order to support President Trump, they would have to say that their job was bogus, or that they had done something wrong or corrupt, or that, you know, that they had basically run an election that was not right. And I think that's hard to do. Basically, you have to say that you did a bad job. People aren't usually willing to do that, especially if it's not true. Whereas the elected officials really had nothing of their own on the line. They had nothing to lose, apparently, by undermining American democracy.
And what does that make you think about moving forward, considering the concerns that you raise in the book about how we are not really the democracy that we like to think that we are?
I think it's a very dangerous time. I mean, like the fact that an entire party or many elected officials from one entire party, that we have a two-party system, and one of those parties has kind of decided that democracy isn't working for them. And so they have no kind of vested interest in keeping democracy working and keeping people's faith in democracy and making sure that voting is free and fair and making sure that people can vote and participate and that their voices, is, you know, all the votes are counted. You know, to have a functioning democracy, you need people to believe in it and want it to continue. And the fact that so many Republican officials kind of just slid into this, like, you know, refusing to actually say what the election did, suggests that they don't think democracy is working for them and they're not going to defend it. And that's, you know, how can you know that democracy is going to continue if one half of the system has no vested interest in it continuing?
With all the concerns that were raised about the ability for voters to actually cast votes because of the pandemic and the reluctance on the part of a lot of Republican officials in several states, particularly swing states, to make it easier for people to vote, there was such a high voter turnout. And I wonder how that jives with the concerns that you raise in your book about all the voter suppression, because in fact, I think this is the highest turnout election ever.
Yeah, and I would say actually that election officials across the country were trying to make it easier. I mean, this again kind of goes to the distinction between people who are in charge of elections and people who are in charge of running for office. People who are election officials, whether they're red or blue, they're election officials because they believe in elections and they believe in people voting. And what we saw across the country was election officials begging legislators to let them make it easy for people to vote. And I would say that election officials did everything in their power, but not everything is in their power. And in fact, some of the things they did that were probably in their power, then of course, the Trump administration and the Republican Party challenged them in court, saying it wasn't in their power. So we had a few of those lawsuits. But in general, you know, election officials in Texas, they opened drive-through voting centers so that people could vote safely from inside their car. And they were trying to make it easy for people to vote. And then it was the, you know, other players who were trying to make it harder. That is the, like, really hopeful thing about this election. We had this record turnout, and a lot of it was because these states that previously have not had early voting or have not let many people vote from home all of a sudden started doing it. And guess what? The states where everybody votes from home, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, we have record high turnouts every year. And so all these other states hopefully are like, oh, well, that worked. And, you know, people could vote, and it's actually, you know, it's easier for election officials in some ways if you do it right. So I hope that that piece of this election will stick.
Well, you mentioned Texas making it easier for people to vote. I also recall that after they did all this outreach with the drive-through voting ability and things like that, that then Harris County was going to shut down all of the accessory voting places except for one. Like, each county was going to have one. And Harris County, I think, has like 4.4 million people, which is larger than Oregon. So how do you consider both of those contradictory reactions that Texas had towards making voting either more accessible or less accessible?
And this, again, you know, the distinction is between the election officials and the legislators. So the election officials in Harris County had put out drop boxes. They had put them out for people to vote, and the legislature made them take them down. So, you know, Harris County election officials were saying, hey, this is going to be a tough year, pandemic. Let's get some drop boxes out. Let's get some drive-through voting. Let's get more centers opened up. And the legislators made them take it back. So that tells me that election officials everywhere want to do their job, and they take their job seriously as helping people vote. And that legislators, lawmakers, at least the Republican lawmakers in Texas, see voters as a threat to them, and they took away those options with the purpose of having fewer people vote.
I wonder what you think about the election results in both Texas and Georgia. And in Texas, I understand that Trump only won by 3 points or less. It was pretty close, and I think he won, I don't remember by what wide margin, 4 years ago. In Georgia, Biden actually won. And I wonder if you see those results as maybe having something to do with the fact that it was easier for people to vote this time around than it was 4 years ago in those two states.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because we had high voter turnout around the country. And yes, Biden won by a few million votes more than Hillary Clinton won in 2016. But Hillary Clinton won more votes in 2016 in a year that it was not easy for, you know, not as many people voted. So the correlation between voter turnout, I mean, I don't know, both parties have taken it at this point as gospel that more voters is good for Democrats and bad for Republicans. I actually think this year doesn't necessarily prove that thesis for either of them. It was a high turnout year. And yes, Biden won, but, you know, Republicans took back 8 House seats. Remains to be seen whether they will win the Senate. So I don't know, if I were a Republican official who has been sort of pursuing this policy of making it harder for people to vote on the assumption that that's how I can win, I would look at this election and reconsider that assumption and think, maybe we can win over voters. We just need to, you know, try and appeal to voters instead of trying to turn them off and shut them out.
Well, even though Trump lost by, I think it's over 7 million votes now, I mean, it's actually a sizable majority, much larger than Hillary Clinton's popular vote win 4 years ago. But there were 74 million people who voted for Trump. So I think if I were a Republican, I'd be looking at that and going, well, we did get a lot of our voters out.
Yeah. I mean, but that's like 14 million voters who weren't out voting for him in 2016 and were this year. So that, whatever that get out the vote or turnout, you know, it was beneficial to them. Even if he did not ultimately win, there was millions of Americans who they got out to vote.
Well, I want to do a little prognosticating right now about Georgia, because we're all looking at Georgia right now. And it's an interesting kind of tug of war going on right now. On the one hand, Republicans are desperately trying to keep those seats, but there are a sizable number of Republicans who are urging Republicans to boycott the election because of the election fraud that was perpetrated on November 3rd. So what do you see are the possibilities of what might be happening in Georgia and what will happen on January 5th when the runoff elections are final?
You know, obviously there's so much attention on Georgia that, you know, those markets are getting flooded with attention and everybody knows how important it is. And I mean, Georgia is really benefiting from years of groundwork by, you know, Stacey Abrams and others who looked at some of the problems, you know, in 2016 and 2018 and said, we've got to fix some of this. And they've made progress, which is what you see in the election results with Biden winning there. So I don't know. It's a big question mark, because in general, a special election like this in January would have very low turnout. And I would expect that with all the attention on it, it's going to be, and also with Georgia, you know, still doing early voting and vote by mail and continuing to make those things easier, I would expect it to be pretty high turnout. And then, yeah, the question of Democrats working on turning out their base, getting them to vote by mail, getting them to vote early, and Republicans having this harder message of like, maybe you should boycott it entirely because it's fraudulent, or you should at least not vote by mail because that's fraudulent. Maybe there'll be a really hopeful outcome that will say, hey, this strategy of undermining democracy and undermining elections actually loses you elections. Knock on wood. One can hope that could be the result.
Do you think that what we saw in Georgia, both on the ground on the part of voters in the days leading up to November 3rd, and then the ensuing 6 weeks after the election, while they recounted and they recounted again, and they were attacked, both the governor and the secretary of state, who were Republicans, who were attacked blisteringly by Trump. How do you see that maybe transforming the future of Georgia electoral politics?
That will be really interesting to see. So, on the one hand, people who are local Georgians are seeing their Republican elected Secretary of State, who they voted for and who is, you know, continues to say that he ran a good election, being attacked by the national machinery. So one of the things that has happened in recent years in the United States is all politics has become really national, whereas previously it was local. You know, people knew more, you felt more connected to your local or state government, and national was sometimes far away. And now it's so aligned, you know, people just, they know whether they're a Republican or Democrat, and that's very much based on the national party identity. And so then they're just kind of voting down ballot for their national alignment. But that kind of possibly creates a tear in that alignment of saying, yeah, I'm a Republican in Texas, but what's up with this national Republican Party attacking my local official who I voted for and who's doing a good job here in my state? I don't know. Could happen.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Kristen Eberhard, who's author of Becoming a Democracy. So let's talk a little bit about the title of your book. Why are you calling this book Becoming a Democracy? A lot of people think that we live in a democracy here in the United States of America.
And, you know, the United States, we hold ourselves up as being, you know, the oldest democracy, or, you know, we have the longest running constitution. And I know Americans, we think of ourselves as a democracy. But if you look back, you know, at our founding, I mean, the Declaration of Independence has these high-flying values about we the people and all created equal and all have inalienable rights. But then when you switch from the Declaration of Independence to the actual Constitution, it's not as high-flying. And, you know, the original Constitution counted enslaved people as 3/5 of a person and didn't allow them to vote. So it very much did not treat everyone as equal and did not give everyone a voice. And the whole idea of a democracy is that the power is ultimately flowing from the people, as opposed to, you know, a monarchy where the power is flowing from a king, or, you know, from some divine power. In a democracy, ultimately the people are the ones who are supposed to be deciding. And now you elect people to represent you and become the president or your lawmakers, but ultimately you have the power. Back in the early days, that wasn't true. Less than 10% of people were allowed to vote, which means that 90% of people didn't have a say. And so the power of the democracy was not flowing from them. So we've made these strides over the years, right? We we said black men could vote, and then we said women could vote, and then we said, you know, you don't have to pay a poll tax to vote. So we've sort of expanded this idea that, you know, we're growing into this idea that we're actually a democracy, but we're still not there. We still have ways of holding back people who otherwise are eligible to vote from actually having their voice heard.
So you, in this book, suggest a bunch of remedies that would increase the participation in elections and would make the country a lot more democratic. So what I wanted to do is start by looking down at all the institutions we have and sort of examining how undemocratic they are. And I guess we'll start with the Electoral College, because that's on everybody's radar right now, and especially since 2016, there's been a lot of talk about doing away with the Electoral College. So let's talk about what's wrong with the Electoral College and why it might not be so easy to do away with it.
The original idea for the Electoral College, if it had ever worked that way, is not a terrible idea. So that at the time that they were writing the Constitution, there were 13 colonies. Each of them kind of thought of themselves as their own little country. And it took a long time to try. It took weeks to travel from, you know, one end to the other. And there was no telegraph, no telephone, no television. The framers looked at this and said, well, how could these 13 colonies elect one person? You know, each colony is just going to nominate their own favorite person. And then all the voters there will vote for that person because that's who they know and that's their home turf. So they thought, okay, well, let's have then this intermediary group of people who know the candidates and have worked with them and know what they are like to work with, you know what kind of a leader they are, what kind of values they hold, and we'll be able to say, look, we've worked with George Washington and Jefferson and whoever, and we know that for this moment in the nation's history, this person is the best person for the job. That doesn't sound like a terrible idea, right? It's kind of like having a knowledgeable interview committee, fine. But of course, it never, ever worked that way. The Electoral College has always been a rubber stamp for the parties. So instead, we have this system that really doesn't make any sense at all, where people are voting for the presidential candidate. So originally, the ballot, actually, you voted for an elector, not for the presidential candidate. You were saying, like, is this person a knowledgeable person who I think will make a good decision for the country? Now, we go and vote. We fill out a ballot for the president. And then that gets sent through this weird distorted filter, which may or may not select the person who we voted for. So that doesn't really make sense. You know, either you have this intermediary knowledgeable body that is actually deliberating and actually making a decision about who's the best person, or people are voting. And right now we have neither. And that doesn't make sense to people. It doesn't make sense for the country. One third of the time elect somebody who most people did not vote for. That doesn't make voters have confidence. It doesn't give that leader a good mandate. But our Constitution is the hardest in the world to amend. And so the Electoral College, that idea that you have this intermediary body is written into the Constitution. So that's hard to change. But the good news is the Constitution does not tell the states what to do with their electoral votes. It just tells them how many electoral votes they have, and then it's completely up to the states to do what they will with that. So a thing that states can do is agree amongst themselves to give their electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the most votes nationwide. So right now, most states have agreed, their legislatures have agreed, to give their electoral votes to the candidate who wins the most votes in that state. They didn't always do it that way. That was a change that happened through the 18th century.
Actually, can you go back a little bit? I'm curious about what it was like in the beginning. So let's talk about how the Electoral College initially worked, and then we understand how it works now, and then how it would work in your perfect reality.
Yeah. Well, the very original Electoral College, every elector got two votes, and then the second place person became vice president. So you didn't run in a ticket. You actually, usually the opposing party would become the vice president. And then they figured out that didn't work very well. That was too divided. You know, we already have very divided government with two different equally powerful houses plus a president. And now you had two equally powerful president plus a vice president who was always opposed to him. So they fixed that. Then most states gave their electoral votes on a proportional basis. So if 30% of the people voted for this candidate and 70% for this candidate, they would give their electoral votes proportionally. Then states started to figure out that they could have more clout, they could have more power in the campaign process if they gave all of their votes to one. They'd get more attention because it essentially kind of puffed them up, made them bigger. So once states started changing to that, saying, no, we're not going to do it proportionally, we're going to do it all for one and one for all, then the other states started saying, whoa, now they're getting more attention from these campaigns because they're basically more important. They have more electoral votes to give to one candidate. So then almost all states ended up changing it too. It's kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like an arms race. Like once one state does that, the other states kind of have to, or else they're going to get left behind. So we now have almost all states do it that way, where they give all of their votes to one, even if that person, you know, in many cases, won less than half of the votes in that state. They get 100% of the Electoral College votes.
It seems like when they were giving a proportional amount, that's closer to the National Voting Act that
you're talking about. Yeah, it's closer. It still could result in a difference between the will of the people and the Electoral College because of the distortion that the Electoral College gives. You know, it's not perfectly based on population because it gives everybody two votes for their two senators. But it would get you closer.
Yeah, well, if you knocked out those two senators and you just, like, for instance, in Oregon just had 5 electoral votes as opposed to 7, I'm wondering why the proposal that you're talking about, which we'll get into a little more detail now, why do you think that's fairer than just if we went back to proportional voting from the Electoral College and we don't allow the two Senate seats to be included in the electoral votes?
Okay, so there's just the mathematical concern and then there's the practical concern. So mathematically, it's still not perfect, right, because it's a little chunky. Right, so take Oregon. If we had 5 Electoral College votes in a close race, they'd always go 3-2, which is 60-40, even though most races here are like 51-49. So even if you got rid of the Senate, it's at least proportional population, that's still a weird chunkiness that you wouldn't get by just counting up all the votes. So that's the sort of mathematical concern. Is definitely a lot better than what we have, but still not quite down to like every vote actually counts. You know, in Oregon, it would still be kind of like, you know, it's probably going to go 3-2. So it doesn't particularly matter if I come out and vote because the chances that I'm going to push it to more than 60%, you know, where you would get a 4-1 are really low. So who cares? Whereas if every vote counts, then yeah, my vote is adding up the tally for that candidate and it could make a difference. So that's one thing. And then just the practical concern is you'd have to amend the Constitution.
So let's talk about the proposal that you are supporting and that is getting some support around the country.
Yeah, so the proposal is a way to basically move to a popular vote without amending the Constitution. So the idea is that because states are in charge, states can choose to say, instead of giving all our votes to the person who won the most votes in the state, we're going to give all our votes, all our electoral votes, to the candidate who won the most votes nationwide. And once you get enough states in agreement to do that, that they have 270 or more electoral votes, in other words, enough electoral votes to actually decide the election, then this agreement goes into effect. So basically, states have signed on saying, once enough states are signed on, we'll all jump into action. Because if you jump into action before enough states are signed on, now you're just like, you know, maybe throwing away your votes. If, for example, Oregon is signed on and say Trump had won the national popular vote, but Biden had won in Oregon, then Oregon would just be giving their votes to Trump for no reason. But once enough states are signed on, then it essentially means that whoever wins the most votes in the country will win the Electoral College because all of these states that are signed on will all give all their Electoral College votes to that person who won the most votes in the country.
So, in fact, it's kind of just making the Electoral College like just a pass-through. It doesn't really count anymore.
So it's essentially saying, yeah, we're going to keep this because we can't change the architecture, but we're going to switch to a thing where actually people are electing the president. Actually, when you vote, you are actually voting for the president as opposed to this weird system we have now.
So the Electoral College would be more like the Queen of England.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's there, but it doesn't matter. What matters is your vote.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Kristen Eberhard, who's author of Becoming a Democracy. Well, besides the Electoral College, which everybody's been talking about for at least the last 4 years, actually for the last 20 years since Al Gore, who was the last candidate before Hillary Clinton to win the popular vote and lose a very highly contested election, actually, by losing the Electoral College. What are some of the other concerns that are probably just as big as the Electoral College, but are not quite as focused on?
Probably the biggest problem with American democracy is the Senate. The Senate is very unusual internationally because of how undemocratic it is and how powerful it is. So there are some other countries that have somewhat undemocratic second bodies, but none as undemocratic as the Senate. And of those, none is nearly as powerful as the Senate. And so we have this body that doesn't represent Americans and is able to block legislation, block judicial appointments, block cabinet appointments. So it's hugely powerful and not representative of the people.
So how do we get rid of the Senate? That's going to be pretty hard, too, isn't it? That's in the Constitution also, isn't it?
And the Senate is much harder to deal with than the Electoral College. I mean, this is the nice thing about the Electoral College is because it is kind of left up to the states, there's some room to help it evolve. The Senate is a huge problem and a very intractable problem. So the book, Becoming a Democracy, is all solutions that we can do without a constitutional amendment. So the thing that we can do without a constitutional amendment for the Senate is break up bigger states. So the basic reason that the Senate is so undemocratic is it gives two senators to each state, regardless of how many people live there. And that was like kind of problematic at the beginning with the colonies. The biggest colony was 13 times the smallest one. So that was a pretty big gap, but they struggled along. But now we have the biggest state is 70 times the smallest state. And the result is that, you know, nearly half the country lives in 9 states. So they have 18 senators and half the people. So that is now getting to a place of just unmanageably undemocratic. So the solution is, because the problem is coming from this big disparity in size, we actually can make the bigger states smaller without a constitutional amendment. The state has to agree and Congress has to agree. So we could take those 9 biggest states where half the people live and break them up into smaller states so that, you know, each state gets 2 senators, but, you know, maybe we say we go back down to just the originally disparate size, you know, that the biggest state won't be 13 times bigger than the smallest state. So we're just back to where the founders were, which is still not great, but it's a little bit more manageable.
There's been a lot of talk for many years about California breaking up. The biggest one was just break up Northern California and Southern California. And that's when Southern California was really Republican and Northern California, parts of it, were very, very Democratic. Culturally, that seemed to make a lot of sense. What's interesting now is that California, I would split it more east-west than north-south in terms of the political divisions. But California is overwhelmingly a Democratic state. At least it has been in recent times. How would you break up California so that it made sense regionally? Because, I mean, one of the things you mentioned in your book is a lot of states have a lot of different diverse and maybe contradictory regions stuck together, and there's not a lot of uniform collective vision of what the state or what our values should be statewide. So I can see that in California, in New York, Florida, maybe Texas. In Oregon, maybe I'm just a bit of a romantic, but even though I know that there's a lot of political divide between Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon, I also think there's a lot more connection than there is between like New York City and upstate New York or Southern California, though actually now I would think more like the Inland Empire of Southern California versus the Bay Area. So how would you break up California, at least in that as a model for making a state that would be in sections that were more manageable and more cohesive, as well as giving more people an actual vote?
I'm going to, as a fellow Oregonian, I'm going to push back a little because there's actually a pretty active campaign for Eastern Oregon to join Idaho.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
And it's because, you know, Oregon, like California, you know, we have these very populous communities along the more western part of the state, and then the eastern part of the state is much more rural. So they feel often like they're not represented in the state government because Democrats control the state legislature, and they get upset about some decisions that get made. And I mean, there was the whole Malheur County occupation.
That was actually coming from outside the state, because the people in Harney County themselves were not supporting that to begin with. I look at the state of Oregon, and because you could also look at Douglas County, which would be part of Oregon, according to these guys. And Douglas County has some people that are really opposed to the values that are represented in Salem. Let's do California, because California actually has more, it's a lot more variety, a lot more diversity. And I think there's a lot more diversity in the different parts of the state.
So California, to get it down to where each mini California is no more than 13 times Wyoming, you have to divide California into, I think, at least 13 different states. So yeah, there have been these proposals. I mean, I think there was just one on the ballot to break it up into three. There was one on the ballot a few years ago to break it up into six. My general approach would be to say, let's try and keep like county lines intact. The only problem with that is that that gets you, you know, LA County has over 10 million people. So, I mean, LA County would be its own state right there. So let's keep county lines intact, and then let's try and keep, you know, communities of interest together, which is sort of what many independent redistricting commissions are charged with, is to say, okay, is this a community? Do they have something in common, either geographically or politically, or, they have a sports team? Is there something here that makes them feel cohesive? And let's try and keep those together. And if you do that, it ends up looking like, you know, you have, well, LA County is a state, and then around San Diego, sort of the more populous coastal part is a state, and the inland, the southern inland part is its own state, and then the Inland Empire is a state, and then there's sort of the Bakersfield area, the more agricultural area becomes a state, and then you've got the Bay Area is a state, the Sacramento area is a state, and then Northern California, which is more sparsely populated, I think not San Francisco, but north of that.
Well, I want to get to the other side of it, which you're talking about merging smaller states. And you push my buttons as a former New Englander, because you were talking about putting together Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. And I spent a lot of time in those states when I was growing up. And they're very different, each one of them. And I don't know how you could get people from Vermont to want to join Maine. And then the people in New Hampshire would have their own issues. I wonder the justification for that and how you would convince people who have such strong state identities to want to merge. North and South Dakota is a different story. And as you talk about in the book, they were once one state and they were divided. But I would really argue against combining Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. So why do you think they should be combined?
I mean, some of this is so sort of just thinking about what are states? What are they for? If you think of it as sort of your regional identity, and then are there things that would be better done at a broader area? I haven't spent any time in New England, so I'm just going to come back to my home in the West Coast. I think about if we had smaller states, states would mean something a little. So here, where we have like the big mega state of California, and Washington's pretty big too, smaller states suddenly means you have this closer local identity. And then maybe there are things that you do regionally. So states, you know, if you got them down small enough, they just take on a more local meaning than some of our bigger states have. And maybe what you're putting your finger on is that those Northeast states already have that very local identity, and they don't have this super mega identity that Californians have, where you say you're a Californian, like, what does that mean? It's very different to be a Southern Californian or an Inland Californian or a Northern Californian. And maybe Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, they're already like, I know what it means to be a Vermonter. And so maybe, you know, we do go for trying to get states smaller, and then think about what other things we do regionally. And, you know, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire are already all members of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative for regulating climate pollution on a regional level, because it doesn't make sense to do it at that kind of a small state level.
Well, actually, I'm sort of more of a fan of breaking up the United States.
There we go.
Back in the 70s, there was this book called Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach. And it was a stupid sexist book, but it had an interesting notion. And he actually included Ecotopia. It started the border between Washington and British Columbia and went down through the Bay Area. Because I guess he was from California, from Northern California, so he wanted to include it into this cool place. But at a time, it was when we, at least here in Oregon and Washington, definitely felt like we didn't live in the United States because the values seemed so different, particularly if you were a hippie living in the Northwest. And I wonder if you just want to run that thought for a moment, and maybe it's that the United States is too big, and maybe we should break up into separate countries.
Well, I have to say, when Texas, you know, filed these lawsuits and then there was talk of it seceding, I was like, great.
Go for it.
Do it, man. Yeah, and I think about, well, the United States is so big, and maybe it's really more analogous, you know, the entire United States is more analogous to the entire European Union rather than the United States being analogous, like, to Britain. The United States is 10 times as much population as Britain, and yeah, we have very big, and land mass-wise, I think we're probably bigger than the EU. You know, we have this very diverse, spread-out country. And maybe instead of continuing to try and be a country and, you know, hating each other, maybe it would be better if we were smaller countries, but under the umbrella of some kind of a looser government. I guess this is going towards like a looser federalism, right? That at the time of the Constitution, those colonies really thought of themselves as countries, and they were sort of trying to join this loose federalist structure. And it has since become a much more cohered, gelled country. But now maybe we're heading the other way, where we need to have some smaller countries that can do what they want and can, feel some more control over themselves. And we're joined loosely into the United Nations of North America.
Well, growing up in New England, I had this strong sense of living in a region. And I lived in Massachusetts, and there was a difference and a little bit of competitiveness between the six states in New England. But basically, we thought of ourselves as New Englanders. And I think one of the appeals to me for moving to the Northwest was the only other part of the United States where I felt like it had as strong a regional identity. Though it was interesting that it's either two or three states, depending on whether you want to include Idaho in the Northwest. And I don't think Idaho wants to be included anymore. So it's just the two of us. And then sometimes we will include British Columbia as well.
Well, I don't know. As sightline, you know, we're Cascadia, which is sort of the Northwest ecoregion, and we're Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Alaska, Idaho, and Montana.
Montana's on the wrong side of the Cascades.
Yeah. we're reaching. We're stretching.
It's the opposite of Eastern Oregon wanting to join Idaho, I guess.
Yeah, we're trying to bring it all in.
But I do think that there's a sense when you live in a region, I mean, the Great Lakes is maybe another one where there's a very strong mm-hmm. identity. But most of the United States, I mean, this Texas has its identity. California has its. I think Florida does. And the rest of the Midwest is kind of vague and the South is kind of vague. So
I don't know. I feel like the South has an identity.
Wow. Yeah, they're still fighting the Civil War.
Yeah, they're still like...
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KOD XLP FM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Kristen Eberhardt. She's the author of Becoming a Democracy, and Kristen is with Sightline Institute, which has been trying to reshape the ways we think, live, breathe, and eat here in the Northwest for a number of years. And I guess vote has become the big thing since this past year. Well, let's talk about different ways of voting. Changing the state lines is a little bit harder for me to wrap my brain around, and maybe for a lot of listeners, but how we vote, I think, is a lot more within our grasp. And we have examples of different kinds of voting than what we do in most regions of the United States as great examples of what we can look for.
So the big difference between the United States and most sort of established democracies is the United States uses this single winner district first past the post system to elect our lawmakers. And it's really only England and former colonies that still use it. Every other developed democracy that has, you know, written a constitution in the last century does it a different way. And we are just still doing it because that's what we do. But changing that could make a big difference for how our system works. So basically, other places use some form of proportional representation, which means that the lawmakers are supposed to proportionally reflect the voters. And this is actually something that many of the founding fathers wanted. They just didn't have the math for it at the time. They didn't know how to accomplish that. And so they used the, you know, they used kind of the best available technology at the time, and the state of the art passed us up during the 20th century, and we haven't upgraded our system. So those systems result in more parties having some footing, and kind of depending on where you set the thresholds, you might end up with, usually you still have sort of two bigger, you know, center left and center right parties, and then a couple of parties who also gain, you know, 5 or 10% of the seats. And the United States, I mean, we can see this pretty clearly in this post-election period, that there's this sort of tension between the progressive wing and the moderate wing of the Democratic Party, because really those are two different parties, or they should be. In any other system other than the United States, those would be two parties. We would have a progressive, you know, socialist Democrat party and a moderate center-left party. But instead, our voting system means that really only two parties can survive, because there's only one winner in every district. And so those two distinct groups are kind of forced to have the same party label, which then is confusing to voters who hear like, oh, wait, Democrats are for this, this, or that. But my local candidate here in Georgia or whatever doesn't talk about that. And it's because, yeah, basically they're a whole different brand. But they have the same label, and you're supposed to like know what's inside that soup can, even though the label looks the same. And other countries get a different label for different flavors of soup.
Here in Oregon, when I first was living here almost 50 years ago, the Republicans in the state were, by many measures, would have been Democrats in other parts of the country. I'm thinking about Mark Hatfield, Bob Packwood. Tom McCall started out, he was a Republican actually, and he created, with the help of some other people, our land use laws. And actually, one of the most famous Democrats back in the early 70s in Oregon was Wayne Morse. He was famous because he was one of the two votes against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which enabled the Vietnam War to start. He started out as a Republican, too, and he broke with the Republican Party for a lot of the same reasons that people now, like Steve Schmidt and people like that, are breaking with the Republican Party, because it was becoming too far to the right. And I don't want to kind of lionize someone like Mark Hatfield and certainly Bob Packwood that much, because they had a lot of other issues that were very conservative and aligned with Republicans, or in the case of Bob Packwood, a lot of corruption. But there was a sense that you could talk to the Republicans. Now, the state party now, I think we had a bunch of QAnon people who ran. So what do we do in this situation where actually we have one party, the Republican Party seems to me to be this far-right neo-fascist party now, with a few people like some of these heroic secretaries of state in Arizona and in Georgia, who are standing up and who really support democracy with their bodies. And then the Democratic Party, which is all across the spectrum, even though I think it's also becoming a lot more progressive. So it seems to me there's a problem right there in terms of divvying up parties the way you think about it in a more sane country somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, exactly. Same thing with the Republican Party. And you can see this when you look at the 2016 primary, right? So President Trump won that primary, but he only had about a quarter of the votes from the primary Republican voters. So the most dedicated Republicans, you know, more of them were voting for the Jeb Bushes and the John Kasichs. And so that is a different kind of Republican Party. But because there's only one Republican Party, once Trump became the helm, even though he not just a quarter of the country, this is a quarter of Republican primary voters supported him. And yet the party kind of became him, because there's only one. And then you have these, you know, the Mitt Romneys and the Susan Collins, who are like, wait a second, this isn't my party, but they're kind of screaming into the void.
And also going along with it.
Oh, or they're going along with it.
I mean, Mitt Romney did vote for impeachment. I hand that to him. But then he voted for Comey Barrett.
And he at least acknowledged the election results. I mean, in any case, he's clearly a different thing than Trump. And yet they both have the Republican Party label. And so for voters, when you're just trying to figure out, like, what is this thing all about? And if you listen to a speech by, you know, Marco Rubio, and you listen to a speech by Donald Trump, they're different things. and you're only left with one label. So just imagine if the United States were like pretty much every other developed country.
Canada, I think, has four parties often.
Yeah, and Canada. And so Canada is actually really interesting because they use first past the post like we do, but they have a really distinct regional parties that kind of diversify their party structure a little bit. So they have two dominant parties, but they have these other parties that gain a few seats, and that gets them at least a voice in the conversation. It gives voters at least some options.
And actually, the NDP actually has won elections. I mean, they've had premiers both in British Columbia and in Alberta, and the two premiers were really different, actually, too.
Right, yeah. So just imagine if in the United States, you know, A, we just had more parties at the federal level. So imagine if we had, you know, a progressive party, a center-left party, business, you know, Chamber of Commerce party, and then a populist nationalist party. It would just change the conversation. It would just be more clear to voters who was what and what they stood for and what they were working on and whether they were really representing you. And then the second piece is, yeah, imagine if we had regional parties were distinct from national parties. So you could be a Hatfield Republican in Oregon, even if to be part of the Trump party, you had to be a Trumper. You could say, no, I'm not part of that party. I'm a Oregon Republican. The fact that we don't have that makes it hard on voters because you go out and you vote for a party, and then they end up not doing what you thought they were going to do. And, you know, for most voters who have busy lives and like they went and did their civic duty that day, they don't have time to try and parse like, wait, why are they not doing what I want? Oh, it's because of first past the post. You know, no, like nobody's thinking about that. They just want the party.
Well, when we're talking about first past the post, I kind of, because you have some other options about how we would elect people. And I want to kind of get into that before we're out of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, proportional representation, which is this idea that if 10% of voters want a Green Party, Green Party representatives will be able to win 10% of the seats. And if, you know, 20% want a progressive, 20% of progressives will win seats. There's various ways of getting there. A lot of other countries use some kind of a party list system, which is very effective, but probably in the United States, because we're used to parties being confusing and not super trustworthy because of, you know, being all in one big tent, probably a party-based system wouldn't work here. So here, it's more likely a candidate-based system would work. And one way of getting there is with a ranked choice ballot. So you might have, for example, for Oregon's congressional delegation, we've got five representatives. So instead of putting them each in a district and you only get to vote for one, you know, the one from your district, you'd have them all run statewide. You'd get to rank them. So every person would get to rank them. And then the top five would go to DC on our behalf. And the result would be, of those five in Oregon, very likely one would be a Libertarian, one would be a Pacific Green Party, you know, and then the other three would be more, you know, maybe a Progressive Democrat, a Moderate Democrat, and a regular Republican. So we would have this much more reflective, diverse candidates representing us.
Now, one of the troubles like I was having when I was reading your book, trying to get into this broader mindset that the book is about like really giving everybody an opportunity to participate in democracy and to learn to listen to each other. Some of these devices that you're talking about would limit the democratic control, both locally and nationally, and it made me upset. So how do you respond to people who are either diehard Democrat? I mean, I'm not even a diehard Democrat. I just really don't trust the Republicans very much anymore. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I think Oregon, actually, the Oregon State Legislature is a great example of this. In Oregon State, Democrats dominate, right? So they have control of both branches of government and the governorship. The House, the Senate, and the governorship. And so this idea that, well, if you had more parties, maybe the Democratic Party, such as it is right now, might not win all of those things. And so it would, you know, does that mean they would lose power? So I would say that in Oregon, what would likely happen is that a coalition of, Working Families Party, Green Party, Progressive Party and Democratic Party, which is the same people, you know, kind of, you know, or at least the similar ideas that are floating internally within the Democratic Party right now, right? Those working family ideas and those Green Party ideas are in there somewhere. They just get sort of suppressed down under the big party umbrella. But those representatives would then be able to more publicly talk about the Green Party agenda and the Progressive Party agenda and connect with voters more directly. Voters of that ilk would feel better that their views are getting expressed and their bills are getting introduced. And ultimately, probably the Democratic Party could hold together that coalition to pass the things that are important to it, you know, to pass the budget, to pass transportation reform, or, you know, all the priorities that are important.
But how do we keep the Republicans from walking out?
Oh, well, that's a whole other...
That's for another show. We'll talk about that maybe in a couple months when the session starts again.
And that's... But I think the thing is, this is, you know, in these more proportional systems that other places have, you do have to have a pretty big coalition to pass things. But then they have safeguards that, like, yeah, you have to build support. You can't like ram things through when you've got 49% of the votes. You've got to have more support than that. But then also that they have more protections for that little party, or that extremist party, which the Republican Party is right now, can't block everything by just, you know, saying no all the time. Like, if you say no, then you're not at the table. Whereas in our system, because we're set up a kind of assuming we're going to have these two big tents that are reasonable and are going to talk to each other, and yet they don't. One extremist group can walk out and block climate action in the state of Oregon. So I think having more voices at the table, but then also having more safeguards that a tiny minority can't stop the gears of governance from working.
Well, one last thing. This is another thing I don't know if you imagined as you were writing the book, is there's been a growing level of violence on the part of the hardcore Trump supporters. And I wonder, how do you see that can be dealt with in the coming months so that we just don't wind up in a really giant mess?
I wish I knew. I mean, I see that level of that violence as this is a harbinger of when you have people in power who don't want democracy to continue. They have a lot of, and I guess what I'd say, it's harder, you know, entropy makes it harder to keep things together and organized and working, and easier to tear them down. And I think Americans have this feeling of, like, our democracy has been around forever. It's going to be around forever. Like, I can, you know, I can go out in the street with a gun and it's not going to, like, break the country. But the truth is, when you have one party that thinks it's okay to say that election results might not be legitimate when they are legitimate, that could break the country. You can't assume that we can ride that wave. That has broken other countries. So if we want democracy to continue, we can't treat that like, oh, you know, that like boys will be boys.
Well, Kristen, I think we got a lot more to talk about. So let's check in again in a few months. I mean, okay. Actually, I think that once the new administration gets started and the new session of Oregon legislature opens, we might have more to talk about. So sometime in the spring, and maybe the pandemic will be lessening by then. We can do it in person.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Well, it's good to talk to you. Thanks a whole lot, Kristen.
Okay. Thank you.
We've been listening to Kristen Eberhard, author of Becoming a Democracy, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our Kibwe Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the Kibwe staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping Kibwe on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of Kibwe, or renewing your membership if you are already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll rebroadcast the interview I did in October with writer and butterfly expert Robert Michael Pyle. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Alan Toussaint. Thanks for listening. Enjoy a good and COVID-safe holiday. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Now is the time. Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Iron out their problems and iron out their quarrels and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And do respect to the women of the world, just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land in the world in which we live.
And help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know done well we can work it out.
Oh yes we can, I know we can, can. Yes we can, why can't we if we wanna? Yes we can.
I know we can make it work.
I know that we can.
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh yes we can, I know we can, can. Yes we can, great gosh almighty. Yes we can, I know we can.
Make it work.
I know that we can.
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes.